That's what I loved about Austin, and I try to do that all the time with my characters, is not paint them as completely good and completely bad, but somewhere in the middle and human, you know.
Hi, thanks for being here at the Austin Connection. The Misarrangement of Sana Said retells Jane Austen's Persuasion. It's a second chance love story that, just like Austen's story, is all about family pressures, class pressures, societal pressures, all the pressures, navigated by two people who once innocently fell into fast love with each other and are now reunited amidst conflict and tension. They navigate all the conflict, all the tension, all the pressures, and find their way to each other. What a story. And The Misarrangement of Sana Said puts all this family drama and romance in a New York Muslim family. It's the first novel by Noreen Mukis. Mukis is an engineer working in environmental policy. In her day job, she works on environmental justice for underserved communities and immigrant communities. And that kind of conflict and tension and power structure also comes out in this book, along with the romance. Noreen Mukis is an engineer, a mother, and a writer navigating family, life, love, and environmental policy, just like her heroine, Sana Said. And it's really fun to read it all in a romance. Mukis talked with us about rewriting Jane Austen, finding romance and love in a Muslim family and any family. Enjoy the conversation. You were just saying that you love engaging with the Austen community, and you said that you sometimes are missing that growing up in India. Where did you grow up and how did you discover Jane Austen?
So I grew up in a small town in India, in the pro it's called Uttar Pradesh, but the name of my town is Aligarh. And I went to a convent school. I don't know if you know about education in India, but convent schools are considered like private schools, which have like the best kind of education in India. And they have libraries where people donate books, and they, you know, but most of them growing up were classics because books are expensive. I mean, let's be honest, they're not cheap for people, you know, growing up in India, but especially in that time when I was growing up, there was no ebooks, there was no none of those options. So a lot of the books that we had in our library at the school that I went to were classics. A lot of Agatha Christie, a lot of Shakespeare, a lot of Austen books. So I think my love for Austen started there. My love for reading started there. And you know, I just consumed Austen like crazy. You know what I'm saying? Nancy Drew, Austen, this is all I read all the time. So it was hard to find people, first of all, who read literature like me, like consumed literature like me. And there wasn't so much time, leisure time growing up for us, because there was so much like outside time built into our day. So I was sort of an outcast, always like reading, you know, in my free time, where most of the kids were outside playing and things like that. So I think my love for reading, my love for Austen sort of started around the same time. And, you know, moving here and rediscovering reading and writing in Austen, and, you know, and finding people who loved Austen like me was amazing.
So that's how you discovered Austen. How did you end up writing a retelling of Persuasion specifically? Why Persuasion specifically? And did you start out rewriting Austen, or did you start out as a writer who then decided to incorporate Austen into your writing?
I connected a lot in terms of character with Anne's character and just the family politics. I felt like they're so wonderful and so intricate and so nuanced, you know. So, and not that Austen doesn't do that beautifully in all her books. I think she does that beautifully in all her books, but specifically Persuasion, because most of the people in her life don't give her good advice, especially people she's close to, you know. So I think to me it's fascinating that she still finds her way in among these other people who are constantly pulling her in the other direction, and reignites this friendship and this love with this guy she knew years ago and she's always loved. So I think to me that book has that done so perfectly, and it's also in tune with a lot of Bollywood movies that I grew up watching, because a lot of them are they were back then about familial politics and how protagonists kind of fight those familial politics and come together. So I think it's a combination of Bollywood and Austin that just really draws me to Persuasion.
Let me just say, I love that. And the idea of Anne Elliot just in the mix of all of this and having to navigate her way. And you're right, in your book, in The Misarrangement of Sana Saeed, the pressures are really there. There's at least investment from the aunties and the older generation. There's at least investment and attention. And Anne Elliot is so neglected. So in some ways, it's just such a pleasure and a joy to experience that, for those of us who may feel more neglected, a little bit more like Anne Elliot. But there's definitely that pressure. And Anne Elliot, like you say, does get bad advice. And she has to, even from someone who is rational and who is loving, and she still has to navigate her way. So it's just such a great lesson that that's what is required of everyone, is to navigate their way. At the end of the day, you have to figure it out. And I think the other part of my question, Noreen, was, did you come to writing first and then decide to incorporate Austen into your writing, or did you become a writer because you wanted to incorporate Jane Austen?
I wouldn't say I became a writer to incorporate Austen, but I think that I'm a big fan of the feelings that Austen invokes, and I always wanted to replicate those feelings in my writing. Those big feelings of, I don't want to use the word morality because I think it's misconstrued so much, but I think there is some sort of like, this is the right thing to do. Austen always sort of finds a way to say, oh, this is the right thing to do, and this is what my protagonists are going to do. And they're not going to just like be inconsiderate of the people around them, even though they want certain things in their life. So I think I really like that feeling of community and the feeling of family and the togetherness that she invokes in, because she almost always has these big casts, right? And I write big casts. So I think that's the kinship that to this day I find in her writing and so inspiring. And I try to emulate that in my writing, obviously in my own way. But I came to writing, yeah, I mean, I wanted to be as good a writer as her, but my first book I wrote was at the age of 12, and it was a mess, but it was just, I've always written in my life. Like, I think I was writing more like towards a journalism type of thing, because in school I would always write like letters to the editor about like hot issues and how I felt about them. So I gave up like fiction writing for a while, and then I sort of find my love. So, like, I always read, but I didn't really necessarily have the time to write. But I realized that time doesn't just happen. You have to make time. So, like, finally, a friend of mine pushed me into like this idea of like, can't find a cabin in the woods somewhere and go write. You just have to find it in the chaos of your life, some time to write. So, yeah. So, I
We
think
can't all be Henry David Thoreau, and even Henry David Thoreau had someone doing his laundry, famously, so.
I know. So it's like, I found my way back to writing, and when I did, I found my love for writing characters like Austen, if you could say,
So, okay, I have to ask you about tropes, Noreen. We all love the second chance tropes, and it's so interesting that Austen was not trying to create romance tropes necessarily, we would imagine, not intentionally, but just somehow managed to in these novels that are not necessarily romances, but that are
you could almost say philosophical treatises and feminist treatises before that was necessarily a thing. Well, it's coming right on the heels of Mary Wollstonecraft, so there were feminist treatises out there. But you have to think that that was what was influencing Austen a little bit more than the mashup of tropes and romance tropes that we all love. But nevertheless, she started something, and we all love the second chance romance of Persuasion. But you also managed to have in here not only that second chance trope, but the friends to lovers, and at the same time, the enemies to lovers, all at the same time, simply because our two persons meet each other later and don't recognize each other and don't like each other, but yet they were childhood friends. I don't think I'm giving too much of that because that's almost the setup for this. I hope it's not a spoiler. But I just wanted to ask you, what are your favorite tropes, and was this sort of mashup intentional and complicated to write?
I think second chance is my favorite trope. You know, people don't like it. Some people hate it. Some people love it. But
it's
think
very stressful.
It is because, like, you know, the first time around it didn't work out. So what is to say it's going to work out the second time?
Yes, don't do this to us.
Yeah, exactly. I think in their case, you know, in this case, because there was external factors really, and not their own internal arcs that drove them apart, it works the way I wanted it to work. You know what I'm saying? Because, like, for me, it's hard to write redeemed characters, like, that are, I don't know, the cheating trope, or, like, you know, there's the certain tropes that I cannot write because I can't justify them in my personal life, and I can't redeem them in writing, obviously. So I think it's my favorite trope to read and write, only if it's done in a certain way. So in terms of trope, yeah, it wasn't difficult to write because I'm a pantser, I don't plot. So, like, I have an idea of how my characters are going to go, and they sort of, like, behave in a certain way. Sometimes they don't listen to me and they behave in a certain way. I didn't start to write them as enemies. I think it just sort of developed as a story developed for me. But yeah, I had to do it. It was difficult in a way. I had to do it where they weren't jerks to each other. And, like, you know, and then how do you come from that to love, you know, and the kind of love that I wanted, you know, to emulate, which was Austen's characters between Anne and Captain Wardenforth. I mean, that's, you know, it's, like, hard to do that if they're like total jerks to each other. So yeah, in that way, it's difficult to do.
It is. And you really pull that off, I have to say. It's a really delicate balance because you also have some alpha male kind of vibe going on there too. Like, this love interest in The Misarrangement of Santa Said he's just extremely impressive. He's a bit of an alpha male, but he's always pulling for the underdog, including, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but, you know, a young little brother who's on the spectrum and very kind of visibly on the spectrum. And so they're mean to each other, but we like that he is really supporting and pulling and sticking up for, defending the underdog all the time, and this little boy who we've already fallen in love with, actually, in the first few pages. He loves his McDonald's sundaes and Happy Meals, and our main character just really loves him and is actually motivated by him. So many things that you've set up in this that kind of direct our motivations and come together to have us really liking these people who don't like each other somehow. So yeah, very complicated to do. So does Austen help with that?
Yes. Oh my God. I mean, I think about the relationship that Anne had with her father. You know, it is such a nuance. Like, it wasn't just that he was this vain person who did these things, but, like, she did have deference to his father about certain things. You know what I'm saying? Like, and the relationship she had with her mother and the relationship she has with her sisters. Oh my God. Like, it is so nuanced and it is so well done. and only Austin can do it without like painting them as villains completely. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I've learned from her books so much is like Darcy is not the bad guy that he is in the first act of the book. You know what I'm saying? Like, and she does this so well. And I think that's what I try to do with my characters is like I try to show them as, you know, everybody has good or bad days, and everybody has awesome days, even though their rest of the life has been crappy to them, you know. And the like her mother, for example, she's had a difficult life, you know.
Sana Said's mother?
Yeah, Sana Said's mom.
Yes,
Because
yeah.
like people hate her, you know.
She's worked at McDonald's.
Yeah, and she's a single mom who had no money and everything that she had in her life taken away from her. And so she wants certain things for her daughters and her son. And that's why she is the way she is. So like, that's what I loved about Austin. And I try to do that all the time with my characters is not paint them as completely good and completely bad, but somewhere in the middle and human, you know?
Yes, and I think you're so right. What Austin is r really, a purveyor of realism, and probably an early, if not the first, purveyor of realism, and the philosophical balance, the philosophical realities of human nature is something she's totally experimenting with, and I feel like she's been sort of undervalued on the philosophical side of things just because she's writing within a marriage plot.
Yeah.
But that makes her what I call the decoy heroes. And you have one here in The Misarrangement of Sana Said as well, which is that charming guy who's like ridiculously charming and in the right place at the right time and also smart and also seems to be rather kind. And we're all drawn to him as our main character is. And it's Wickham, it's Willoughby to a lesser extent. And it's your Adam in this, just really such a charming, perfect guy. And Austin, like you mentioned about Darcy, is showing that balance that we're not all good or bad, but go for that. There are certain characteristics you should go for. You should be going for honesty. You should be going for genuine kindness. Make sure someone's willing to listen to you and learn and grow. And so it just makes the love story. So I think that's what we love about Austin love stories is there is a philosophical basis, an exploration of human nature that rings true for us, even if we can't articulate it. But we love it in those choices that you see a heroine having to make. Austin Connection, we're talking with author Noreen Muchis about her book The Misarrangement of Sana Said. It's a retelling of Jane Austen's Persuasion, and it's got all the conflict, tension, and family drama of that story, and all of the romance of that story. Throw in some environmental justice sensibility, put it all in a contemporary Muslim family in New York, and stir. Noreen is an engineer and mother and writer working on environmental justice with underserved communities. In the next part of the conversation, we talked about writing issues of class and money into a rom-com, and we continued our chat about Jane Austen's decoy heroes, the guys that are so charming that our protagonists can't resist, and sometimes neither can we. Why is that? For Noreen Muchis and her protagonist, Sana Said, our decoy hero distracting us from our person is the character of Adam. Here's the rest of our conversation.
A lot of people have said, it's like, oh, I was Team Adam, you know, the whole time. I think Adam deserves Sana. And I was like, I think the big ingredient missing in their relationship was love, you know, that she had experienced with someone else. And I think that's where Anne's relationship with Wentworth comes in, is like she had experienced that love and that. And that's why, you know, you can't replicate it with another thing. It's almost like, you know, people have baggage, you know, like, so she had that baggage, she had experienced that. So yeah, I mean, definitely, I think I wrote Adam like in line with a lot of Austin characters, like especially Willoughby's character, I think fascinating because, you know, the whole thing is like, you know, he is in love with Marianne, I think, you know.
Yes, I think so.
She doesn't explicitly say that, but that's Austin. Like she never, like she leaves these hints. I love it. It's beautiful. She loves these hints, leaves these hints. But I think that's what it is with Adam and Sana too. Like he is not letting himself fall for her, and that's the flaw. Like you know, risk-taking behavior. Like he doesn't want to take the risk because he's been hurt before. I didn't explore too much of his backstory because, you know, obviously the story wasn't about Adam, but he does have a backstory and there's a reason why he is that way. But he's so risk averse and you can't be that way in relationships. You know, like you have to be willing to take the risk and be your complete self and be loving the way Daniel is, to open up to spending your whole life together. And I think that was his flaw. And I think that's kind of what Austin does really well in these other love connections that the heroines make is like there is something that's holding them back. And I think that's what it was with Adam.
Yes, you're absolutely capturing that calculation that everyone's having to make between, as you say, the risk in love, the risk, so many other risks, so many things at stake to do with family and finances and welfare of everyone, you know, then and today. We still have to think about healthcare. We still have to think about care for our loved ones. We still have to calculate these things and balance them in our choices, even for love. And Austin's showing that balance. It's interesting. You make me realize, Noreen, one, I have a blog title that I want to explore sometime, which is that Jane Austen doesn't have to have a take. And it's very funny because I think people, you said, well, I don't really know. You know, Austen, there's so many things Austen doesn't show. She shows the attraction to these decoy heroes like Willoughby, and in Persuasion, of course, it's William Elliot, the cousin, who is very calculating and maybe just a step too calculating, we find out. And then that pull toward love. And but Austen's not really saying one or the other. She's just really presenting the reality. And I think that's what she's doing because we tend to expect her. I think that critics through the ages have expected that Austen had a take. She had a position. No, Austen was a philosopher who was an artist, first and foremost, who was exploring these balances in our lives and the realities of, in our lives in a way that was risky in itself, right? And that wasn't a formula, even though she was writing within a formula, but definitely innovating through that formula. So basically, all that to say, yeah, I love it that Austen really doesn't have a take. We don't have to try to decode Austen. She herself wasn't decoded. But Persuasion, I agree with you, is where you see that best, the complications and complexities of life best recreated through a novel, you know, with Persuasion. But Noreen, you mentioned in all of this, you mentioned class. You overtly address class right away. And I love that. Would you like to see more class just kind of overtly handled in rom-coms?
Yes, and my third book that I'm currently writing is A Great Expectations retelling. Lo and behold, all about class, but it's set in India, and it just explores class because it still exists in India, to be honest, that divide between the rich and the poor, and you know, and just like even if it's not money, it's like you belong if you are certain, like if you're Nawabs, that's what it is in India, used to be in India, you're always considered that, and you nobody who is a worker class can ever reach that class. So I mean, I grew up with it in India, the caste system and the class system. So it's deeply ingrained in my writing because, you know, that's my lived experience. And I bring it up because even in a country like America, you would think that we're like the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest nations of the world, that this wouldn't exist, but it does exist, especially in tight-knit communities, immigrant communities who come to this country with so little, some of us who come to this country with so little. and it's a way for us to survive, you know, and live the American life, you know. So yeah, so I mean, I definitely want it. It's always going to be, I feel like, part of my books, that class system that exists here and that I grew up with, you know, because it's, my characters will almost always not be billionaires, you know, and have everything in terms of, you know, people have, like, they would always struggle to get to a certain level because that's part of their growth, and then, you know, like Sona's mom in thinking she wants her to have a stable life comes from the fact that everything was taken away from her. So I think, yeah, I think it's sort of a lived experience, so it has to reflect, especially in my debut, it has to reflect in my books.
That's wonderful. I love that. And there is something that's, there was something that was really lovely about characters in a rom-com, just like hanging out at McDonald's. And I think that that's because, you know, so many of us are normal people are not doing as well. We're just not doing as well. The disparities and the income gaps are increasing. I work for a public university. Funding's a big problem. I've definitely struggled financially in my life. And even though I might not look like it on the outside, but you know, it's things are tight for a lot of people. And so the answer for a lot of us is just getting a sundae from McDonald's. So it's really
Exactly.
cool. It's really empowering to see that reflected in rom-com. So I love that.
Oh, I will always write about class. I feel like I will never just, like, I think people will, like, you know, when we were trying to categorize my book, and because it's like the thing that publishers do, they try, and I was like, it'll never be like a fluffy, I cannot write just like a fluffy rom-com that is an escape from reality, which, I mean, I have a lot of respect for, to be honest. I mean, I read them all the time. But I don't know, writing for me is like a lot of it I have to pull from real life experiences. And I was like, I was never in an escapist world when I was living in India, and even here, like when I came with two suitcases to this country, it was never like an escapist rom-com type of life for me. So I don't know if I can ever write from just that escapist point of view. You know what I'm saying?
Right, and neither did Jane Austen.
Yeah, right. And like I said, I all the power to people who can do that, and I love them and I read them all the time, but it's just like something that I don't think I can ever write.
Well, tell me more about that, Noreen. I know that you at the moment work as an engineer and in New Jersey, and you're day job comes through, which is a really fun part of this, with environmental issues and engineering and law, which is where your day job sort of intersects as well, you were saying. What does that do for you, the process of writing, and what were you doing arriving in this country with two suitcases? There's two big double questions.
Yeah, so I came in as a student. So we only were allowed to bring two suitcases. And it was a big upheaval in my life, you know, because I had never lived away from home. So, like, basically packing my whole life in two suitcases, like, you're asking me to take my journals, to take my beloved things, you know, memories of my childhood, and everything in two suitcases. And I had to pick a lot of things that were important that I had to take. And so in other words, I came here with very little and on a scholarship and a very limited budget. And I could, as an international student, I could only work so many hours at pursuing the graduate degree. So yeah, so, and you know, I don't come from money. You know, my father died when we were young. So my mom was a widow, and she was a stay-at-home mom and didn't work. So financially, we never had too much money, and America was sort of like my pathway to better things for my family and for myself. So I think a lot of it came from there, like that wanting to do better for myself, and you know, having my give my mom a better life and myself a better life came from that. And my day job is a lot of it that I'm working on currently is about immigrant communities and trying to make life better for them environmentally, because there's a lot of communities that live in, especially in North Jersey, where it's a lot of industries there, and there's a lot of air pollution, and money shouldn't have a monopoly on the environment, except it does sometimes. And so I'm very active in environmental justice initiative. There's environmental justice initiative, which sort of bases that, water and air and everything, there shouldn't be a monopoly on that, because, why should immigrant communities or poor communities suffer with environmental health risks because they can't afford to be in these green big communities with like a lot of open air and like gardens, and like they can breathe freely. It shouldn't be a monopoly like that. So I think that's where I am with my day job, and I wanted to bring some of that aspect, because it is a real issue, in my book. Like I said, I can't just write an escapist romance. Sometimes I give myself away. So I wanted to bring some light on that topic too, is the reason why I incorporate that part in my book.
That's wonderful. Well, Noreen, this has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
That was Noreen Mukhis talking about her new book, The Misarrangement of Sana Said, just out this month. It's a contemporary retelling of Jane Austen's Persuasion. Find out more about the book and Noreen at austinconnection.substack.com. You can find a transcript of our conversation, and you can find many, many, many more conversations about all of Jane Austen's novels and how they connect to us today. It's an entire Jane Austen community and conversation waiting for you that you can join at austinconnection.substack.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. See you next time here at the Austin Connection.